Welcome to University Matters. This is Patricia Camilleri, Director of Communications and Alumni Relations here at the University of Malta. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research projects, their international networks, about their aims and aspirations. I'm very pleased to have with me in the studio today Dr. Conrad Thig. And Dr. Thig is an architect, urban planner, and architectural historian. Just a few words about him. He graduated in architecture and civil engineering at the University of Malta back in 1988. He worked briefly in the architectural atelier of Professor Wilhelm Holzbauer in Vienna. Architect Thig completed his postgraduate studies with a master's degree in urban and regional planning from the University of Waterloo in Canada in 1991, and went on to read for his PhD in architecture from the University of California in Berkeley, USA. He's a fellow of the Salzburg Seminar, Austria, and has been admitted as a member of the CICA, CICA, the International Committee of Architectural Critics. He has also co-authored with the late Dr. Quentin Hughes the two volumes Malta, the Baroque Island, and Malta, War and Peace, an Architectural Chronicle, 1800 to 2000. Architect Thig has contributed to several prestigious international architectural journals, including Arca, Demetra, Palladio, Spazio e Società, and Annali del Barocco in Sicilia, mainly on issues relating to architectural history, design, and urban regeneration of historic town centres. He has also participated in several international architectural design competitions. Dr. Thig currently serves also as a member of the Planning Appeals Board. A very warm welcome to you.
Thank you, Dr. for inviting Thig. Me to the programme.
This is a subject that this architectural history, which is really your forte, is a subject that makes people get quite hot under the collar sometimes, and perhaps it is a misunderstood area of study as well. There are so many different aspects to it, so I hope during this very short 25-minute opportunity we'll have a chance to discuss some of the main issues of the area. A first and very obvious question is, why should the study of architectural history actually be relevant to today's world?
Well, architecture is all around us, literally speaking. I mean, you could imagine it as it's a repository of the collective memory of society. Wherever we are, we're surrounded by buildings, structures made by human beings in time. So people do get upset when they see familiar buildings which are knocked down. It brings about a sense of alienation in their surroundings. I'd also like to refer to what a famous architectural historian, Nicholas Pevsner, had once said, this was way back when even architectural history was very different from what it is today. When, for example, there's this very classic example where, for example, defined Lincoln Cathedral as being worthy of study, being architecture, but a bicycle shed was something irrelevant. Today we have a very different view to that. We view things from a material culture point of view, where anything which is made by human beings is a response to social, economic requirements. So, for example, if you're studying, let's say, just even Caracas, the high-rise buildings of Caracas, and even the favelas where the slum dwellers live, are equally relevant. Obviously, if we look at the annals of history, they're biased and loaded in terms of the great architecture of the cardinals, the popes, the princes, of the great patrons, so to speak, and for example, famous architect Sir Edwin Lutyens, the great architect who did New Delhi, once said that great architecture is produced by great patrons. But that's only one aspect, that's the monumental side of architecture. I think now we've adopted a much more multidisciplinary approach. We get urban geography, cultural anthropology, planning, and other disciplines in. So we're more interested in the built landscape. Obviously, the natural landscape, that's another discipline. But we're built in basically the landscape that we as human beings have formed and evolved over time. So it's a very, very wide, all-encompassing discipline. You know, it's very hard to encapsulate. And the boundaries are much more fluid today.
I think as a historian, obviously, your job, so to speak, is to, on the one side, look back and see actually how things have evolved from the very first buildings. At least I would imagine that that's what you would do. You would sort of look and see how things have evolved, looking into various countries beyond our rather Western-centric idea, looking into the history of the built environment all over the place. And then there might be another, I imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, another sort of side to your study where you're looking at actually what has provoked the change in the buildings as time has progressed.
Let's take the Maltese case. For example, obviously our glorious period, so to speak, in terms of architecture, are the megalithic period, you know, our great temples, and the architecture bequeathed to us by the Order of St. John. But those are only two great chapters in our history. There's also medieval architecture. There's also, you know, a legacy of British colonial architecture, which unfortunately has always been a bit like the Cinderella in Maltese architectural history, so we've lost a lot of that. And I think the age when we start kind of putting like a ranking in terms of which is the best or better is a bit of a very hollow, superficial argument, because at the end of the day, they're all reflections of our nation at different periods in time, so it's not a question of having top of the pops kind of league. One has to distinguish a bit between the study of architectural history and then obviously conservation, preservation, and that movement, which is obviously a much more grassroots movement, where obviously one has to be informed, and obviously one architectural history feeds into conservation. But when we talk about the actual study of buildings, we have to remember buildings are not static objects, not like a painting done by a painter, and after 300 years, if it hasn't been retouched, basically it's the original work. Buildings are functional entities. Uses change, so a building would have gone through a whole series of different changes, uses in time, and obviously those would require physical changes, different patrons using the building, different architects reacting, so you have a much more complex layering of both entities and also interventions, and one has to try to dissect those and analyze them and relate those to the circumstances at the time. I mean, before, history used to be, architecture used to be very much looking at facades and plans, examining them in a formalistic way, and almost kind of dissecting them, kind of in terms of geometry proportions, and looking at them almost as pretty pictures. But that obviously is a very limited view of history. Now we tend to look much more at the significance and how that building came about and how it evolved, how it changed. And you can't divorce buildings and structures from the context. For example, about a year ago, I was doing research on a proposal in the 1930s, when obviously in Malta at the time, it was from a socio-political point of view, there was the big language crisis between the Anglophiles, the Italophiles, obviously had the emergence of fascism in Italy, Malta being a British colonial island, feeling the kind of threatened as well by the expansion of Italy under Mussolini, and I discovered a proposal to even build a Casa del Fascio and a Centro dell'Italianità right outside Valletta. And obviously the proposal never materialized, but there were plans to actually build this Centro dell'Italianità and Casa del Fascio. Now, if you just look at the building and the facades, without knowing the whole political, historical context of Malta and the 30s, it would almost be superfluous to comment, because obviously it is a product very much of the situation at that time, you know. So you really can't separate politics, economics, social aspects from the building or structure you're commenting about.
And I suppose these issues of cultural identity and national identity are not just recent aspects of buildings or the built environment. This must have been the case for a very, very long time, almost from the first time that people started building somewhere to live, really.
It's an issue as well of assessing the importance of a building. For example, when the British were here and they decided that there was a great need for them to build a place of worship for the British community, and they wanted to build the Anglican Cathedral in Valletta, I mean, basically, they knocked down, they demolished the old German Auberge, the Auberge d'Allemagne, something that would be unthinkable today, to demolish an Auberge to build another building. But obviously, land being a very finite resource in Malta, they wanted to have a strategic location in Valletta. We also have to approach it from a sense, from a point of view that it doesn't mean that the value of a building is significant just because it happens to be old. For example, you know, what really pains me at times is there are a number of buildings in England, they've even started scheduling buildings that were built by buildings by Norman Foster, some of his pioneering work, which is our only 20, 30 years ago. We have this mentality that, you know, a building, in order to be worthy of preservation, has to be at least 50 years old. You know, we just try to quantify it by time without looking at the architectural merit, its cultural significance, and so we might be losing a lot of even, you know, significant, for example, lost a lot of buildings from the Art Nouveau period, I mean, especially around the Slim area. You know, even some significant buildings that were built in the 50s, I could mention, for example, a building which was severely compromised was Huntingford's Ta'ala Primary School, which was one of the best exemplars of the international modern movement style. So the whole idea is that throughout time, there are different milestones and buildings which are maybe superior representations of that particular epoch in time. And so in preservation, I think one has to try to distinguish between what is really worthy of preservation, what is important, and what is also dispensable. You know, I don't think we should go towards a very fundamentalist approach of trying to preserve anything at all costs, because that, in my view, diminishes then the value of saving what is really significant. So I think one has to take I know it is a controversial subject, you know, but it is trying to reach a balance between, you know, what is worthy of conservation, especially the memory of the place, and at least to be replaced if it is dispensable by something which is of a superior quality and significance.
I think the quality really is the word that I think is most significant. I mean, personally, I'm very interested in traditional architecture, obviously, but I'm personally not a purist in that sense that I don't actually object to seeing something modern next to something Baroque, on condition that it is good quality, that the materials used are good quality, because I think that really is the key.
I mean, I'll give you a few examples. For example, I'll take two examples from Vienna, which is the first district of Vienna, just opposite. I'm not stating that I agree with it, but it was a very controversial project when in front of St. Stephen's, Hans Hollein, who's a very well-known postmodernist architect who really flourished in the postmodern period, built Haas House, which is a very modern, eclectic kind of collage of things at the intersection of the Kartenstrasse and the Graben, which is the heart of Vienna, opposite St. Stephen's, which is, you know, a 13th, 14th century cathedral and an embodiment of Vienna. And obviously, it was a highly controversial project. For example, take Prague, and where there was, and in this case, you know, it was a case of, you know, bad manners architecture, where in the center of Prague, in the old historic centers, you had a building by a very famous American architect by the name of Frank Gehry, who designed this building, which is all twisted and warped with windows floating. Actually, it has an acronym by the name of Ginger and Fred, because they're like dancing buildings. And the effect was that on distortion, of getting an impact of contrast between buildings. But that contrast can be painful, and contrast can be, I wouldn't say pleasant, but provocative. You know, so I don't think there is something which is a clear-cut approach to the problem. But
yes, that building I've seen pictures of, the Frank Gehry. He's the architect of the Bilbao.
Bilbao is rather different. Because Bilbao, I think, he wanted to make a big architectural statement in a place which was hardly on the tourist itinerary. So it really is an iconic building, which has really turned the fortunes of Bilbao around, because people just go to Bilbao to see the Guggenheim.
Absolutely.
So sometimes, you know, you are looking for that iconic statement. Like, for example,
Your first architectural image of Sydney would be Utzon's Sydney Opera House, you know. So there are buildings which are intended to be iconic statements, okay. And sometimes buildings are designed in a way they almost want to shout and shock, you know, so like different art forms. Now, I'm not prescribing that for any city, for example, because I think cities vary in terms of their ability to be able to absorb such statements. For example, let's take a very simple example. Obviously, for example, take the Imdina, for example. It's a very more fragile micro kind of urban enclave than Valletta. Valletta probably would be able to take a good quality example of modern architecture. If it's well designed, I'm not saying anything goes, then Imdina would probably be a bit too disruptive.
So small.
So small, and it would really. I don't think it has the capacity in terms of both size and the way it's the morphology that it can take any of that. So I think one can't make dogmatic statements by saying no to any modern interventions without the city, but I think you have to see the context of each and every individual place, you know.
Some of the places, some of the cities I've visited, I've been full of admiration for city planners. Some definitely I haven't had any admiration for at all. But for example, when you think about Barcelona in Spain, Gaudí, okay, before I went to Barcelona, I had obviously seen pictures of it. But I hadn't really understood just what kind of an overwhelming sort of impact actually Gaudi's architecture had on Barcelona. And it is such a strange type of architecture, and it must have seemed incredibly strange in, what, 1910? When was Gaudi? Yeah. You know, Gaudi remember the dates better than I. Yeah. And yet they had the courage or the audacity to let him build those amazing buildings.
Well, I mean, you have to remember that in Barcelona, Gaudi, I mean, there was very much the Catalan spirit as well. So, I mean, some of the great artists like Dalí, Catalan, I mean, there's the surreal spirit. So, I mean, he came into a phase where there was the Art Nouveau, where it was a great innovation. Obviously, he was allowed to basically interpret his dreams, because some of them are like fantastical dreams and which are still very surreal to this very day, but also inspired by nature. I mean, you look at a lot of Gaudi's buildings, they're inspired by forms from nature, from this even the basic structure of a leaf or of a tree. And so, I mean, if one were to dissect his buildings, there is a structural reasoning to them, a structural logic. So he follows others like Viollet-le-Duc, and his background came from almost a neo-Gothic kind of building. Obviously, also a very religious architect working for the church, the patronage, and also in some of his buildings, for example, even the design, the sculpturing of the rooftops, almost in the form of the back of a dragon, being, you know, symbolizing as well, you know, with Catalan symbols. So again, Gaudi wouldn't have been able to do that, for example, in a Scandinavian context. For example, it's an effect of the materials that he used, the religion, the geography, you know, the... So, I mean, he was a regional architect, so to speak, that all his works today, architects, especially the kind of jet-setting architects, the famous ones, tend to build buildings all over the world. And sometimes, let's face it, architecture does not travel well. You might be a very brilliant architect in your local context, where you know the local materials, the history, but then basically transplanting one's architectural expression into a totally different context somehow then becomes rootless, you know. I mean, rootless without roots, so to speak. Not rootless in the terms of power, but rootless without being rooted, without connecting to the place in terms of the memory of the site, you know, of the site.
Also, perhaps one of the problems is a sort of a prophet in his own country problem, where you have people who were creating new images, new architecture in their own country, but haven't really been appreciated. I mean, a lecture of yours I happened to attend, you were talking about modern Maltese architecture. And you mentioned names which, frankly, although I take an interest, an amateurish interest in the subject I hadn't heard of. And I thought, yes, you know, the buildings you refer to are definitely were definitely very, very interesting and I'm sure worth preserving, though obviously that's always a dangerous issue. But perhaps you could tell us something about that, those contemporary
architects. Yes, I mean,
architects.
For example, we were to look in the post-war period in Morton, I mean, the 60s, well, you had an architect like, you know, Richard England, for example, doing the Manikata Church, which I think is one of the most important post-war buildings in Malta. But the way it's been treated recently leaves a lot to be desired. You know, I mean, there was, in my opinion, a Belvedere playing field built just right in front of it, which really clashes badly. Buildings are mushrooming all over around it. I mean, it was supposed to be like an icon for a small rural hamlet sitting on a ridge, inspired by local forms. It was also a response to the Vatican Council too. So it merged new teachings even in the practice of the liturgy with the church form. Because even at the time, the locals, before they embarked on Richard England's design, wanted to have another replica of the Mostar Dome on a smaller scale or Rimchar. They wanted to go for the grand gesture. So it took quite a while for him to convince them that they should take another part, you know, something which basically was an architecture which was representative of the community. Other examples, for example, Anvin Cremona's own house. Although he wasn't an architect, he was a great artist, a great designer. I mean, it's a real tour de force in terms of a sculptural piece of work. I mean, Victor Pasmo, the British artist who was based in Malta, I mean, it's almost the equivalent of the, you know, of the British Picasso, so to speak. And you see his work, his own sculptural works, intertwined with a vernacular piece of Maltese architecture, a typical Maltese farmhouse, where he left his mark in his own sculptures and his interventions, so where you see the synergy between the vernacular, traditional, and the modern. Other examples, Basil Spence, who was the architect of Coventry Cathedral, who had a holiday home in Morton, Fawara, and he also made a number of interventions to this building. And other examples of buildings where I still think there is space for modern architecture to engage in a kind of syntax, in a kind of discourse with the old. I'm totally against the idea of stagnating the old and trying to reverse back the clock. I think that is something which is unnatural to do. I mean, I can't think of any place, any city which just freezes or stagnates. Another very good example of a contemporary architecture by a young architect, Chris Briffa, and the two a place I can't mention it by name, no commercial publicity, but a night spot restaurant in the fortifications in Valletta, which tried to merge a modern minimalist expression and make something which at night is like a beacon of light, and there is total respect for the old fabric and the intervention, okay? Well, without trying to mimic, I mean, it's not like trying to fool somebody into thinking that this is looks old, you know, that's a completely out, you know.
That no goes design, against you know. Any...
It goes against the grain, I mean, because we believe that there should be integrity and honest in terms of also pronouncing, you know, and making clear cut where this is the authentic, this is something that has been adapted now for today's use. But I mean, uses change. I mean, if you look at St. James Cavalier, obviously it's a war machine transformed into a center for creativity. Obviously a totally different function. The building represent had a raison d'etre, which was that of serving as part of this war, very elaborate war machine that defended Valletta. Now, I mean, 500 years later, it has a different function. And you have to adapt the buildings for that, but in respect of the memory of the place, you know, I believe.
Going back to your work as a researcher, you're also, I don't think I mentioned at the beginning, of course, your lecturer here at university. Where do you go for your research? The traditional places and the non-traditional places?
It depends very much on which period. For example, if one is doing research on the 19th century, on the British colonial period, then the first place archives one would visit would be the National Archives in Santo Spirito. So, for example, I was doing some research recently on William Scamp, who was
a British architect working with the Admiralty, who although was very briefly immortal for a brief period between 1841 and 1845, in those 3 years was prolific. He did the first dry dock in Malta, the number one dock. He did the naval bakery, which today is the Maritime Museum. It was the largest naval bakery. It served the whole British fleet in the Mediterranean at the time. And he also solved and, you know, brought to completion, because it was there was a big controversy, the Anglican Cathedral, which basically had started off under Richard Lancashire, and it was structurally in a very precarious condition. He had very little knowledge of local building practice. The building was condemned as structurally unsafe. And he took over and saved the day, because obviously it was a major source of embarrassment for the British colonial government that they couldn't even...
PR disaster.
And it's a bit unfortunate, and it's a bit tragic. Richard Lancashire died then soon after the age of 38. And rumor has it that he might have even taken his life away. And so, I mean, there's a human dimension to that as well. So I would go, for example, in this case, you would research anywhere from the archives at Kew in London, where there are all the plans of the Dockyard Creek area, because obviously it was in the Admiralty. The Dockyard had their own plans. Santo Spirito, where there are all the correspondence between the Secretary of State to the Colonial Office in London. So the British period, for example, the National Archives. If you're doing work during the time of the Order of St. John, then obviously the archives of the Order and the Biblioteca then would be the other natural place where to go. Then there is also the notarial archives, where one can also do a lot of research, but one would really have to know what one is searching for. Otherwise, it's like looking for the proverbial needle in the haystack. So that is as regards primary sources in when we're talking about local architecture. But then, it depends what you're writing about. If you're doing something which is more on a macro scale, you're writing a survey, then secondary sources become very important, because obviously you're giving a general overview. But then if you're focusing more at a micro level on a building or an architect, then you really have to delve deep in the archives.
Unfortunately, run out of time. Thank you so much, Architects Sake, Dr. Conrad Sake, for coming to talk to us about the fascinating subject of architectural history.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's program. I do hope you can join us again next week for another in the series, University Matters on Campus FM. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.